Tucson Crash Fire and Rescue Unit, OPCON to MAG 39. I'm speaking with Staff Sergeant Richard E. Takas of 31 Waldorf Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut. Next of kin, Mrs. Cora M. Takas, his wife. Same address. At any airstrip in Vietnam today, there's always the chance of emergency, crash, a fire. Today, we're speaking with Staff Sergeant Richard E. Takas of Bridgeport, Connecticut. He's the crash chief of the Quezon Crash, Fire, and Rescue Unit, controlled by Marine Aircraft Group 39. Sergeant Takas, what is the mission of the Crash, Fire, and Rescue Unit here at Quezon?
Our job is basically rescue. Rescue of the pilot that is in the air coming down in an emergency. His aircraft can be shot up. It could be just on a normal malfunction of parts in the aircraft. But he has to come down, and if he comes down at Quezon, we're waiting for him. I have 10 men here, and we're all school trained. And each of our jobs are taught to each other. When an aircraft informs the tower of an emergency, the crash crew here is immediately responding to our equipment to form up on the runways so that that pilot, when he touches down, knows that somebody is waiting for him here. Our job mainly consists of, like I say, rescue of the pilot. But if the pilot crashes and there is a fire, the men here that I have to go into that fire and pull out that pilot. We also encounter ordnance on the aircraft, and sometimes this gets to be somewhat of a hazardous job. The men like it. I don't think any of the troops that I have here would like to switch over to another outfit. The morale here is tremendous. And I can see why the Quezon area is, or was held.
Sergeant Takas, you mentioned that all of your men are school trained. What kind of training do they go through?
They go through a 4 to 6 week school at Memphis, Tennessee in crash, fire, and rescue techniques. At the school, they are taught the proper and correct way to go into numerous types of aircraft and to get these pilots and personnel out, extinguish the fire, and try to salvage as much of the aircraft as possible.
You mentioned that, of course, with fire around the crashed aircraft, there's always a chance of exploding ordnance aboard the aircraft. Are you men trained in any way to take care of this?
Normally, no. The EOD personnel here get to the scene of the fire at the same time we do, more or less. And as soon as we can get the fire out, they'll come in and de-arm most of the ordnance here.
What kind of equipment do you work with here?
Normally, we work with MB-5 type crash vehicles, and we also have some what we call 530A structural firefighting rigs. And they're good pieces of equipment. I guess everybody can say in country here, we always need more. And I guess that's just one of the fallacies.
You mentioned before that you and your men are on 24-hour alert every day. Say all the men were down here in the bunker where we are now, and the word came out that a plane was coming in and would have to crash land. What would be the order of things to happen from there on in?
Well, the tower would give us a call over the phone. We'd respond to our vehicles and head for the runway. We'd set up normally in three positions so we can get full coverage of the runway no matter where the aircraft would touch down. Each of the men that I have here at the beginning of the day are assigned to a vehicle and a job. We have rescue men assigned, we have turret men assigned, and handline men assigned. And as soon as that aircraft touched down, the men automatically started assuming the jobs that they're supposed to do.
Now, these three jobs you mentioned, the turretman, the handlineman, and the rescueman, what are their functions?
Well, if the aircraft did come in and crash and start to burn, the first truck at the scene would, what we call, spot or position itself on the aircraft. It would immediately start to dispense with foam. As the foam is being dispensed, we have two rescue men in what we call bunker gear or firefighting clothes, go into the aircraft to pull that pilot out or to assist him in any way that he can get out under his own. While these rescue men are in there, the handline men will come into operation, and they will more or less cover the rescue being made. They'll knock down the small fires in and around the rescue men and try to keep foam or water on the pilot and the rescue men.
Well, Sergeant Takis, have there been any such emergencies here at Khe Sanh in the past few weeks?
Here at Khe Sanh, we've had quite a bit of emergencies here. About 5 days ago, we had an Air Force O-2 observation plane come in with control difficulties. And he informed the tower that he was making for our runway, and he just didn't make it. He crashed off the edge of the runway. We responded. We saw him go in. We made the rescue. It was a minimum amount of fire, and the pilot came out all right. He had just a minor head injury, and I thank his lucky stars that he did come out okay.
Well, these O-2 planes don't carry too much in the way of ordnance, but I'm sure you do get some planes that do have quite a bit aboard. How do you feel personally, and how do you think your men feel going into a crash scene where there's a possibility of explosion?
It's the training that I would say comes into effect here. When we're waiting for a plane, we all know what to expect going in, but as soon as something happens, it's just an immediate response. I don't think the men actually sit down and think going into a fire, well, should I look for ordnance or so forth. They know what to do, they know what has to be done, and they go in and they do their job. And after the fire is over, we hold a critique here to find out who did what wrong or what we can improve. And then it all comes out. But as far as going into a fire, I think they react to the training that they've been given, and they do it very well here.
You mentioned that before you came here to Khe Sanh, you worked on the crash, fire, and rescue units at Dang Ha and Quang Tri. Is there any difference that you noticed between there and here?
Things are a little bit more quieter at Dang Ha and Quang Tri. Basically, the equipment and the men are the same. We rotate our personnel here, so everybody gets a chance to come to Khe Sanh. Believe it or not, most of the troops in MAG 39 in our crash, fire, and rescue unit want to come here. They want to become part of what's been going on around here.
You mentioned the morale is real high here at Khe Sanh. Is there any particular reason for this?
Well, they know they're doing a good job, and from what we can see around us, the different organizations, the infantrymen, the tankmen, the Antos men, all pulling together like this is quite a sight. And it just grows on you. Like I say, the morale here is just stupendous. I can't get over it.
Staff Sergeant Richard E. Takis of Bridgeport, Connecticut, the crash chief of the Khe Sanh Crash, Fire, and Rescue Unit. This is Lance Corporal Dave Jackson at Khe Sanh in South Vietnam. This is a story tape with Corporal Douglas G. Foster, address 2602 4th Avenue, Seattle, Washington, next to Ken and Mrs. Laurie Foster, his wife. Corporal Douglas G. Foster of Seattle, Washington, is now serving in South Vietnam as a squad leader with Hotel Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines. He's on his second full tour here in Vietnam. On the first tour, he was with a civic action group, Lima 7, near Chu Lai. While he was with the CAG unit, some interesting occurrences happened. Doug, could you tell us about this one specific instance?
Well, we had this, when we first moved into this village, the people, there's four villages in our hamlet, and they were all VC, and the people in this one particular village is Cha Tu Tu. They decided that they wanted to get rid of the VC. They wanted Marines to move in with them. And none of them had ever had any contact to speak of with Marines, except maybe a patrol go through here. So when we moved in, there was 11 of us counting our corpsmen at the time. The people, they couldn't speak no English. We couldn't speak no Vietnamese, so we had a little conflict there. And we had this one little boy. His name is Pho. We called him Pho because none of us could grasp the Pho at first. That he could speak a little English. He'd sold coke to the Marines and Army along the Highway 1. So he helped us as an interpreter, more or less. And then after 2 or 3 weeks after the people began to trust us and help us along, things got along pretty good. We took this little kid as an interpreter. But he was too young, and his uncle had been VC, and the PFs, popular forces in the village, had killed his uncle. So they wouldn't trust him in the compound with us. So we had this, they brought us in a regular interpreter, and 4 months later we found out he was VC himself. And this little boy, he was real smart. Most of us took a pretty good liking to him. Like in the middle of the month or something, maybe we'd run out of money, he'd give us money that he'd sell from Cokes, he'd give us the money, and we'd pay him back at the end of the month. Then he had a lot of problems with his father. His father was sick, so we'd loan him money. Well, we wouldn't loan it because the people themselves, they don't like to take that as charity. So we'd buy something that cost maybe 50 cents, we'd give him $2 for it, something like this, to help him send his father to this hospital. And me and him, we was pretty tight, and I wanted to send him to a school. I wanted to bring him back to the States, but at the time I wasn't married. I couldn't do it. So I put in money to the Vietnamese officials to send him to an orphanage. Then when my time came to rotate, he didn't want me to go back to the States, so I was going to stay here. But I was out one night, and they just called me and said I was rotating the next day. It was happened pretty sudden. So I had to take off and leave him. I don't know, I got back to Camp Pendleton, I stayed there a couple months, couldn't get along, I kept thinking about it, so I just come back over and see if I can get him. I'm going to try and take him back to the States if I can.
Well, now this little foe, you say his father was sick, did he have a mother?
Yes, he had a mother and two younger sisters and a little brother. And when when his father was sick and had to go to the hospital, Quang Nai City, then four, at the time he was 12, he'd have to take over the farm. He'd have to miss school. That was another thing, the VC, they were after him, after they found out that he was an interpreter for us, so we'd have to give him an escort to school and back. Two Marines would go with him and two would bring him back.
Would you say he was pretty happy about the whole situation of helping out you guys?
Oh, he really dug living with the Marines, but his mother, she didn't like it too much because she was afraid the VC would get him. Eventually, we'd had several other CAC units that took little kids like this, and the VC got him at one time or another. I got a letter from him in December, but I haven't heard since then. So I don't know. I don't even know if he's still alive now or not.
Now you say you left back to the States. You were rotated back, but really didn't want to go, and we were sitting back there thinking about him, so decided to come back and see what happened. You haven't seen him since you've been back. Do you have any hopes of tracing him down and finding him again?
Yes, right now I'm in the process of trying to get back switched over to the 3rd Marine Division so I can get into another CAC unit. I want to go through the CAC headquarters. I'm going to try and get back to the same outfit or in the same area. I know I know most of the villages and the people in it, and it'd be pretty easy to find him once I get there.
Well, working with Civic Action the way you were in your first hitch over here, did you find it rewarding?
Yes. A lot of the people back in the States, these people are, they're illiterate. And I know this myself, when I first came over, a lot of the Marines, all the people were gooks, which that's supposed to mean foreigner in Vietnamese. And they just come over here thinking in their mind that they kill them all and they hate them. But after you live with them, you find out they're really, really very happy people. They're intelligent. They're not ignorant. They're illiterate is the problem. Most of them, they just don't get the word on things. You'll find a lot of difference after you start living with them, and that you can see how things progress, and it makes you feel pretty good.
Dave, you think the Marine Corps Civic Action Program is doing its job?
Oh, it definitely is. If they could get more of them, this war wouldn't last very long now. They've seen all the difference in the world, like down south, July, where they first started them. Since when I first came over here, there's so much difference. It's really outstanding. You can see the even in the people. Before, they'd look at you like, you were the foreigner, but now you're part of them. Like these people, these Marines that live in the civic actions, live in the villages with the people. They're part of the people. We used to eat chow with them all the time. We taught the kids how to swim. We teach them how to fire rifles, how to work machine guns and things like this. True, some of it could have got back to the VC, but I don't think so. 2 or 3 days before we ever got hit by a large force, we'd know about it, and people tell us about these things. At first, it was different, though. At first, they wouldn't tell us. They wouldn't help us or nothing. But after they found out that we were working for them, then it was different.
The story of civic action in Vietnam, Corporal Douglas G. Foster of Seattle, Washington. This is Lance Corporal Dave Jackson at Khe Sanh in South Vietnam.
This interview is with Sergeant Gene Holley, H-O-L-L-Y, of 2154 Cherokee Avenue. That's 2154 Cherokee, C-H-E-R-O-K-E-E Avenue, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's with the India 3-4, story of a patrol and the capture of numerous weapons.
The face of Khe Sanh has changed in the recent weeks. Now the Marines aren't stuck inside defending the base. They're moving out in an aggressive manner out into the hills surrounding Khe Sanh. Right now we're speaking with Sergeant Gene Holley, a platoon sergeant for India Company 3-4. Sergeant Holley, you were on a patrol on or about the 24th of April. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
About 0900, we moved out on a company minus patrol, and approximately 1,500 meters outside our perimeter, we came upon a small complex of gook bunkers, and at this time we found that they had been hit by an arc light, and there was quite a bit of gook gear, but nothing is essential. It was just basically gook helmets, gook cooking gear, things of this nature. And we continued on our patrol, and approximately 6 hours after we had left, we were heading back to our perimeter. And myself, I was walking with the point squad right behind the point fire team, and we were going through an area which had been hit by B-52s when I looked down and I saw some boosters which are used for 82 millimeter mortars, and about this time another sergeant looked down and he found some 82 mortars. We told our point squad to set up security and check out the area, and at this time we found another complex of bunkers about battalion, no less than company size, and we found quite a bit of gear, approximately 100 Chi-Com grenades, various types of fragmentation and concussion, 15 RPG-2s, which are recoilless rifle rounds. We found six Bangalore torpedoes, which were made out of bamboo and block demolition, and approximately another 100 pounds of demolition. We called back to our battalion unit, and we were not able to set up an LZ to get this gear out. So we buried most of it and took back all the essential gear that we had never seen before. We had some directional type mines, which the Gooks set up in ambushes and things like this. And we carried back all this gear to be studied by our S2 representatives.
Sergeant Holly, you mentioned this was probably a battalion-size outfit of NVA that was in the area before they left. You found quite a few bunkers. What kind of construction was evident within these bunkers?
The construction of the bunkers were outstanding. They were made something like the old Indians would make. They were crossed boards or crossed sections of trees about 6 inches in diameter, and they were big enough for, I'd say, two men apiece. And one type bunker had a 1,000-pound bomb hit directly by it. The only indication we had was it didn't blow the bunker up. It was just on the edge of the bomb crater, and it blew the dirt away. But the people in it, if there were people in it at this time, might have been killed from concussion. But the bunker was outstanding, and it certainly protected them from any shrapnel that the bomb had.
How many bunkers did you find out there?
We found approximately 20 bunkers of this type, and down in the valley a little bit lower, they had a base camp set up, which was just regular Gook-type bunkers with an overhead on them and a lot of dirt, well camouflaged. And we found another 20 or 30 of these bunkers.
Well, from what you found as far as arms and rounds left behind, would you say this outfit was pretty well supplied?
I would say they were. It appeared that they were being hit by an arc light. They jumped in their bunkers, and then as soon as the first wave went through, they jumped out and bugged out. It appears that they were well supplied, but they just carry too much gear. It's unbelievable what one small man can carry. And they had so much gear that they just couldn't carry it all and get out. So they just took off.
Did you find any evidence of automatic weapons there?
We sure did. We found approximately 700 or 800 rounds of heavy machine gun, which is our 7.62 round. And we also found some light machine gun ammo, which was brand new, and they were in boxes.
How about individual equipment?
Individual equipment, we didn't find much of that. Most of it was Chi-Com grenades, which we found in almost every hole, 82-millimeter mortars, 60 mortars, boosters for these mortars, and their fuses. The individual equipment, most of it was taken. We found a couple bags of rice. But there was no indication that that they left any individual gear back, like boots or anything like that.
So you said it was probably battalion size. How many men in one of these NVA battalions?
A battalion size is not as big as our battalions, but there I'd say there's roughly, I can't say because I'm not sure what of the Gook structure, but they have I'd say 500 men, no less than that.
And you think it was the arc light that scared them off?
I certainly do. The hills around here are unbelievable. It's just utter devastation. And the arc lights definitely took their toll on the Gooks out here.
Well, what happened after you finally got this area secured and well searched?
Well, after this, we buried our gear, carried in what gear that we wanted the S2 scouts to look at, and then we came on in and set up our perimeter for the night, which was our base camp. And basically that's all I can tell you.
So you'd say it was a pretty successful patrol then?
I definitely would. We were pretty happy about it. It was our first patrol. We'd only been here about 2 weeks, and all the men were pretty happy about it. It was a good find, and we definitely heard them when we found it.
Do you have any idea what 3-4 is going to be doing from here on out?
We're going in the hills soon, and we hope to get a bunch of Gooks. The only thing is we always take casualties when we go. You can't help it. These people are really good, and you can't underestimate them because they've got good leaders and they've got good discipline, and the only time you ever make contact with them is when they want to, and when you make contact, you've got to fight your way out. they're good, and you don't underestimate them. But we always hurt them more than they hurt us, but you can't get out of it without casualties.
How long have you been in country now?
I'm going on my 10th month.
Your 10th month, and did you say we're doing a pretty good job over here?
I'm very pleased to say we are. The Marines are fighting hard over here. We're taking casualties, but once again, this is a thing about combat that every unit suffers when they actually go in and fight.
Sergeant Gene Holley, Platoon Sergeant in India Company 3-4 here at Khe Sanh. This is Lance Corporal Dave Jackson at Khe Sanh in South Vietnam.
The next interview is with the S-2 intelligence type clerk who evaluated the equipment just talked about in the previous interview. Interview with Lance Corporal Thomas A. Jacobs, G-A-C-O-B-S, of 2007 Wall Street, W-A-L-L Street, in Sioux City, Iowa, S-I-O-U-X, City, Iowa. His next of kin is Virginia R. Ping, P-I-N-G, at that address. Interview follows with Lance Corporal Dave Jackson.
A member of the S-2, or intelligence section, for the 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. Tom, you were out on this patrol with Sergeant Holley. From the intelligence point of view, how successful was it?
This was a very successful patrol. We did find a lot of information. We did find two booklets that were to some significance to the MVA. One was kind of calendar-like, but he was keeping dates on it, the day they attacked, the day they were hit by arc lights and stuff like this, and by the sounds of things, his morale was very low, and it was a very good patrol. We found lots of gear. All of it was MVA. It wasn't VC, and we found these RPGs, which the division's been really after us to get. They're one of the best weapons the MVA have. This is something like our 3.5 rocket launcher. It's a very accurate weapon, and it is fired through the tube like the 3.5, but it's got a round. Maybe I think it's just a little bit bigger than our 3.5 round. It'll go through eight bags of sandbags, and it turns into airburst. It's known to turn into an airburst after it burns out if it's still in the air. It's a very powerful weapon. It will knock out a tank very easily, and we were very happy to get these, but we did not find any rocket launcher tubes. They keep those pretty much with them. They'll take those for the last resort. We did find A2 mortar rounds. I believe in the area, somewhere in that area, there was the mortar tubes, in which they were found later by another company. I was told, anyway, by the S2 chief. We found around 80 to 90, 82 mortar rounds. We found 70, right around 70, 60 mortar rounds. And we also found over 100 pounds of demolition, TNT, and their type of C4, which is supposed to be better than ours. We also found one AK-47, which was very bad damaged. We found some Bangalores, which were about 5 feet to 6 feet long, maybe 20-some blocks of TNT inside of them. These Bangalores are used for blowing our wire just before their attack. It's very effective.
Well, Tom, they call these things Bangalore torpedoes. How are they constructed? What do they look like?
They are a bamboo pole that's been split down the middle, and then they take out these the little there's kind of little compartments in bamboo that separate them. So they take all this out of the middle of the bamboo pole, and then they put TNT in there, and then they wrap it up real tight with bamboo string or whatever they can get their hands on to tie these. They're very effective on the wire. It's a good way to blow wire, that's for sure. They are detonated by a blasting cap and fuse. And that's about it about those. Besides, they're very powerful.
Well, you say they use them to blow wire. How does it blow the wire?
They slip this underneath the wire, and then they detonate it, and it tears a hole right in the wire. It's really a good weapon for that kind of thing. I've never seen one until that day, and they look like they're very impressive.
Well, Tom, how many of these Bangalore torpedoes did you find?
We found six of these Bangalore torpedoes. We blew five of them, took one back for intelligence, sent it back to the division.
Well, I'm interested in this calendar diary type thing you found. You say all past events were noted on it, and the fellow who wrote it sounded like he was in kind of a bad way, morale-wise. How did you figure that?
Well, they write on there some, they have a food shortage. They usually write their morale on these papers. Well, this isn't the first time we found papers like that saying that their morale is very low. Found a diary one time which explained the whole thing and that they haven't had food for 4 or 5 days. And I don't know what it's about them, but they like to tell about their morale and other things like that. The calendar was for this year, and we got it up to the day that we found it. It was caught up to that day. I don't know what his rank was, but there was an address on there, so they'll probably check that out because it told an address on there that that he lives or has some friends there or something, so they will probably check this out.
Well, Tom, Sergeant Holly mentioned quite a few large, very strong and well-camouflaged bunkers you found in the area. How do these compare with others you've seen?
Well, I checked those bunkers out, too. I had to go in those to check them out. They are very, very sturdy. It looks like they were prepared for something like this. I've seen other NVA bunkers that I've gone into, and these were way better than the other ones I've been in. These were very well-constructed with very heavy logs. Usually they just use bamboo or small logs, but these were big logs, maybe 5 inches in diameter. They're something like a Indian teepee underground, and it's very sturdy. There were, when they arced like this place, that there was a few bombs that hit close to these, and it didn't even affect them, maybe blew the dirt off them a little bit, but it didn't even affect the bunkers.
Or was there anything else of intelligence-type interest that you found out there?
We found new equipment, some of the grenades and the RPGs. They were all brand new. We found one recoilless rifle. It was a brand new one, still in the tube and all, all put together, just ready to use. But looks like when they arc-lighted the place, they just the NVA got up and left the area, and they left all their gear behind, and I think there's a lot more gear out there, but they just buried it, and we just didn't find it, that's all.
I understand that you found many, many rounds of light and heavy machine gun ammo, fairly new stuff. How do you explain that?
Well, I've never seen them leave stuff like this behind before. They usually try to carry it so we won't capture it, but this was brand new rounds, machine gun, heavy and light machine gun, and it was still in the packages, and it looked like they just were so scared they just left everything behind.
Well, you've been out in the hills now surrounding Quezon. What do you think it looks like?
Well, it looks like it's going to be a hard fight for it, but I think it's just about over. We think they're pulling out away from Quezon because they know that they don't even have a chance here because the arc lights was doing such a tremendous job and taking care of these NVA. they found quite a few bodies. We went out on patrol yesterday. We seen where they had buried quite a few bodies. And we haven't run into any contact, maybe a little bit so far on in our battalion, but the day we got here, another battalion was really hit hard, but it wasn't from ground troops, it was from mortars and artillery and rocket rounds and like that, and there's just no way you can fight that anyway, and you never can tell where they're at anyway.
So actually, you think the future of Quezon looks pretty good from here on out then?
Yes, I do. I think in a few more weeks, they should be pretty secure. They maybe get one or two rounds, but you get that everywhere you go. These hills are going to be hard to take, but I think we're doing a tremendous job on taking these, and the Army and the Marines, which are up here, are doing a tremendous job on this caisson. I heard that there was rumors that they were going to abandon this place, but that won't go because there's too many Marines that have been wounded or died up here fighting for this place, and I think we're going to take this place just like we take everything else.
Lance Corporal Thomas A. Jacobs from the Intelligence Section, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. This is Lance Corporal Dave Jackson at Quezon in South Vietnam.